Part 1. Commander-in-Chief. Chapter 1. 2 years earlier. The Pacific Ocean, December 7th, 1941. The ships have been traveling, secretly, for 10 days. Now, on this quiet Sunday morning, as the first light of dawn winks from the Pacific Ocean, the fleet prepares to change course. There's no land in sight. Measured against the vast scale of the Pacific, this collection of warships is a tiny blip. But on a human scale, the fleet is enormous. 6 massive aircraft carriers, 2 battleships, 9 destroyers, 3 cruisers, 8 fuel tankers, and several small support ships. Below the waves are 23 accompanying submarines. On each carrier, the flight decks are lined with dozens of planes. In total, tens of thousands of crew members are aboard and mobilized. For most of their 10-day journey, these ships have traveled eastward. Astonishingly, their movement across more than 3,500 miles of water, from a secluded bay on East Asian shores to here in the Central Pacific, has remained undetected by radar systems throughout the ocean. Every aspect of the fleet's journey has been planned and conducted at the highest levels of secrecy. Now, several hundred miles south of the Aleutian Islands, the fleet commander issues a series of orders to chart a southern course. As the ships begin to move in the new direction, the slower-moving tankers break off from the fleet. The rest accelerate, going from 20 knots to 24 knots, a speed that provides momentum suitable for aircraft to launch from carrier decks. At 6:05 a.m., a green light is waved on the deck of the flagship carrier. It's a signal to launch. One by one, engines roar and warplanes speed across the runway, rising into the dark morning air above the ocean waters. The other carriers simultaneously launch planes of their own. The aircraft circle above the fleet and begin to maneuver. A total of 183 planes are soon flying south in battle formation, leaving the ships behind. A reconnaissance plane shoots ahead of the others, disappearing in the clouds. The pilot's job is to scout the sea and air ahead, tuning into nearby radio frequencies to see if there's any indication that either the planes or carriers have been detected. 90 minutes later, at roughly 7:40 a.m., the lead pilots can see a sliver of land in the distance. They send a signal to the others. The air fleet remains undetected. Visibility is strong. The coast is clear. Time to attack. The target? A small island of less than 600 square miles. It's a place they're not at war with. Yet the Japanese air fleet commanders are about to unleash the full destructive power of their fighter planes, bombers, torpedo planes, and dive bombers. This is a surprise attack, a preemptive strike intended to inflict maximum shock and devastation. Within the next 2 hours, the world will change. Chapter 2. 4 hours earlier, Washington, D.C. It's 8:45 a.m., and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt is still in bed. He wears a sleeping robe and has a tray of food in front of him. This is no leisurely breakfast, however. He's surrounded by paperwork, and a busy telephone sits nearby. He often starts the day this way, conducting the nation's affairs while under the covers. It's not so easy for the president to move from room to room. Since being stricken with polio 2 decades ago, he's almost entirely without the use of his legs, and he's found that breakfasting and working in bed is often the most efficient way to begin the day. The president was up late the night before. Well after midnight, he was still on a series of emergency phone calls with members of his national security staff. Earlier that evening, U.S. Naval Intelligence Services intercepted and translated a top-secret memo from the Imperial Government of Japan in Tokyo to the Japanese ambassadors stationed in Washington, D.C. The memo was in the form of a 14-point bulletin with instructions to the ambassadors to deliver its message to the Americans according to a prepared timeline. The Navy's intercept contained 13 of the 14 written points, the final section supposedly still to come. In methodical fashion, the bulletin outlined the Japanese response to the latest round of American diplomacy, rejecting what it perceives to be the United States' unreasonable demands to stop Japan's expansion into China and various territories in the South Pacific region. In addition, it views the United States' continued sanctions and oil embargo against it as intolerable. To put it bluntly, ongoing negotiations between the United States and Japan have apparently collapsed. This deterioration is the last thing the president wants. FDR's primary focus, and the focus of U.S. foreign policy in general, has been on providing aid and supplies to the United Kingdom for its war against Nazi Germany. Now, with his legs still under the covers, Roosevelt is rereading the 13-point bulletin and trying to understand its implications. At roughly 9:30 a.m., a messenger from the Navy Department rushes into the room. He has the 14th section, which the Navy just received, decrypted, and translated. This final paragraph officially states what the previous sections already implied. Japan will declare that since efforts towards the establishment of peace have failed, it is impossible to reach an agreement with further negotiations. Minutes later, the president receives yet another decrypt, a separate message sent in parallel. This message instructs the Japanese ambassadors to deliver the preceding bulletin to American officials at precisely 1 p.m., with no indication of why this time of day is so important. Even more ominously, the message instructs the ambassadors to destroy all confidential documents within the Japanese embassy and apparently to terminate their offices. This is not good news. Time to get out of bed. Once up, the president coordinates group phone calls and meetings with key leaders of his foreign policy and national security staff. By mid-morning, they've analyzed the documents. They agree that Japan is probably about to take military action against U.S.-friendly interests in Southeast Asia. Perhaps they'll attack British-controlled Singapore or Guam, or try to seize the coveted oil fields of the Dutch East Indies. They may even attack the Philippines, an American protectorate. If so, what should the United States do? Would these actions demand military response? As his advisors debate options, Roosevelt decides that on this day, the typical Sunday skeleton staff at the White House won't be sufficient. He needs his top people. Soon, the White House operator is making phone calls all around the greater Washington, D.C. area, trying to locate personnel who were out shopping, in church, or with their families. Among those who receive a call is Grace Tully, Roosevelt's personal secretary, who's relaxing at her apartment in Washington, D.C. "The president wants you right away," the White House operator tells her. "There's a car on the way to pick you up." Tully dresses quickly, like a fireman, as she later recalls, and runs outside to meet the car. The growing staff at the White House is tense. A military action somewhere in the South Pacific may be pending. The president's wife, the exceedingly busy Eleanor Roosevelt, had organized a large White House luncheon for supporters that day. "I was disappointed but not surprised when Franklin sent word a short time before lunch that he did not see how he could possibly join us," she later recalled. As is sometimes the case, she'll play the role of president for the visitors, because her husband cannot attend. Instead, for lunch, the president and his longtime advisor Harry Hopkins huddle with sandwiches over a desk in Roosevelt's White House study. They're strategizing what comes next. Then, at 1:47 p.m., the president's late lunch with Hopkins is interrupted by a call from Frank Knox, the Secretary of the Navy. Knox clears his throat as the president gets on the line. Knox's voice is shaking as he says that the Pentagon picked up a radio from Honolulu from our commander-in-chief of our forces there, advising that an air raid attack was on and that it was no drill. It appears, Knox continues after a pause, like the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor? In Hawaii? That can't be right. The U.S. naval base on the Hawaiian island of Oahu was thought to be impervious to attack. It's also, based on its location, far from any Japanese interests. So why would Japan possibly attack Hawaii? Lunch partner Hopkins, one of Roosevelt's most trusted foreign policy advisors, doesn't believe it. I expressed the belief that there must be some mistake, he records in a memo that day. Surely Japan would not attack in Honolulu. But the president has a terrible feeling. He needs to find out what happened. By this point, Grace Tully is at her desk, frantically managing the presidential phone lines. Shortly after Knox's call, the White House operator informs her that Admiral Harold Stark, the chief of naval operations, is on the line for the president. I could hear the shocked unbelief in Admiral Stark's voice as he talked to me, Tully later recalled. She puts him on with the president, and Stark confirms the incomprehensible news. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor. The base was entirely unprepared, and the results are catastrophic. One thing is becoming clear. This will be the worst day of Roosevelt's presidency. During his time in office, FDR had earned a reputation for unflappability. So while his staff begins to react with near hysteria to the news from Hawaii, he remains in control. The president retains greater outward calm than anybody else, as Tully put it, but with each new message, he shook his head grimly and tightened the expression of his mouth. Indeed, the terrible news keeps coming. The U.S. naval base was caught totally unaware. Battle stations were mostly unmanned, with ammunition locked in storage rooms and vaults. The ships in the harbor were sitting ducks. The first wave of Japanese planes set their targets on Battleship Row, where the hulking centerpieces of the U.S. Pacific Fleet were docked side by side. The attacking aircraft struck the USS Oklahoma first, with strafing guns and a pair of carefully aimed torpedoes. Massive explosions rocked the harbor as the fuel tanks ignited, and the huge vessel soon tilted toward port as water flooded through the damaged hull. Minutes later, the battleship began sinking to the bottom of the harbor, pulling more than 400 sailors and crew to their deaths. Within an hour, the entire base was an inferno. Two battleships sank completely, and several other battleships, destroyers, and cruisers were obliterated. The harbor was full of flames and wreckage. A group of Japanese planes also peeled off from the water to strike nearby airfields. The surprise attack decimated what was nearly the Navy's entire fleet of planes on the base. According to early reports, by the time the attacks ended, well over 2,000 American service members or staff were dead. Another 1,000 were seriously wounded. The average age of sailors on the base was 19 years old. Aside from the horrors of the attack itself, the global consequences for what just occurred are momentous. At this moment, Japan is allied with Germany and Italy, nations that are fighting the British in a war that has swept Europe. Japan's surprise attack on the United States has just altered the global balance of power, but it's difficult to grasp the ramifications. The West Wing remains in a state of shock and panic. As word spreads through the afternoon, reporters pick up the story and soon the press corps surrounds the White House. Amid the chaos, at 5 p.m., after a full day of nonstop frantic meetings and phone calls, President Roosevelt slips away to his small personal study adjoining the Oval Office. He's accompanied only by Grace Tully. Tomorrow he will address both houses of Congress. And now, sitting in this study, he needs to figure out what to say. For the past few hours, the State Department has been working frantically, preparing a speech for the president's review. It now sits in front of him, 15 pages long, containing a lengthy history of diplomatic relations with Japan and a detailed assessment of various military responses to the surprise attack. Roosevelt tosses the papers aside. He may be addressing Congress, but his real audience is the American people. Rather than deliver a foreign policy lecture, he needs to speak for a nation that he knows was just shocked to the core. His speech should be short, simple, and strong. Every word counts. With Tully seated nearby at a typewriter, Roosevelt leans back, puffs on a cigarette, and begins to dictate his message. Tomorrow, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Commander-in-Chief, will address the nation. Chapter 3. America tried so hard to stay out of the war. Like many nations, the United States had recently lost many young soldiers in the First World War. In 1919, after the Versailles Treaty brought U.S. troops home, the overwhelming sentiment in America was isolationism. For the average American, the Great War, which caused so much destruction and pain, accomplished seemingly little. So why should more young American soldiers be sent across the ocean to fight and die over border disputes between faraway nations? The disillusion and confusion, felt especially by those who fought or lost loved ones, had a profound impact on a generation of Americans. Then, almost a decade after the Versailles Treaty, the stock market crash of 1929 marked the United States' plunge into a crippling depression. Within a few years, nearly a quarter of U.S. citizens were unemployed, and the nation experienced unprecedented levels of poverty and homelessness. Franklin Roosevelt was elected president in 1932 with a mission to save the country from permanent ruin. Unlike his predecessor, he took bold, aggressive action by utilizing federal government programs to stimulate growth and create jobs. Increasingly, he saw it as a moral calling to try and eradicate the scourge of poverty and better serve those citizens most in need. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little, he declared. Gradually, the economy recovered. Unsurprisingly, during this period of isolationism and economic struggle, the nation's military forces were a low priority. In 1939, America's army ranked only 19th in the world, below Portugal and just slightly above Bulgaria. Nevertheless, the U.S. watched with a wary eye as a young German leader named Adolf Hitler rode a new political movement to power. Hitler spoke in apocalyptic terms, and his National Socialist Party gradually solidified power by successfully purging domestic enemies. By the early to mid-1930s, he was in total control. The Nazi Party, as it was soon called, trafficked in a rage-filled patriotism that appealed to the fears and prejudices of Germany's rural and working classes. Germany had been stripped of power after its defeat in the First World War, and its economy was then hit hard by the global depression. These conditions created anxieties that Nazism ruthlessly exploited. At his huge rallies, Hitler, surrounded by patriotic flags and accompanied by martial music, worked his supporters into a frenzy with bombastic speeches that promised to restore German strength. He spewed anger at domestic enemies, immigrants and minorities mostly, whom he blamed for the nation's problems. As a solution, Hitler and the Nazi Party demanded a return to traditional values and a renewed pride in ethnically pure Germans. Along with its racism and xenophobia, Nazism despised intellectuals, urban elites, and progressive ideas like women's liberation. Party leaders sometimes distilled their ideas into a single term, nationalism, which loosely combined pride in one's country with a fear or hatred of immigrants, non-white minorities, and foreign influence. As Hitler declared in 1940, the concept of nationalism was one strong new idea which would make Germany great again. Hitler and other party leaders based much of their rhetoric and agenda on a conspiracy theory. They claimed that at the end of the First World War, globalists conspired to force Germany's surrender and destroy its economy and culture, and that the Jewish people were behind this conspiracy. By pushing this sinister but purposely vague theory, Nazis could demonize an alleged cabal of wealthy Jews who operated in the shadows, as well as cast blame on the poor and working-class Jewish populations that they claimed were infiltrating European towns and cities to take jobs from honest, hard-working people. Hatred of Jews and immigrants became a mantra that united the party and rallied its working-class base. The Jew has ruined our race, corrupted our morals, hollowed out our customs, and broken our strength, Hitler's propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels wrote in a Nazi pamphlet. As nationalists, we oppose the Jews because we see the Hebrews as the eternal enemy of our national honor and our national freedom. Roosevelt and other world leaders watched as Hitler and the Nazi Party rose to prominence, seized power, and began the systematic persecution of minority groups. In 1935, Germany's new Nuremberg laws encoded white racial supremacy and stripped Jews of citizenship rights. As the Nazis increasingly used violence to eliminate political enemies and brutalize minorities, FDR would declare Nazism the enemy of all law, all liberty, all morality, all religion. Meanwhile, Hitler launched an aggressive rearmament program that violated the Versailles Treaty while using the threat of military force to annex nearby territories that he claimed rightfully belonged to the fatherland. Roosevelt thought Nazism was a great danger and often said so. But even after Hitler invaded Poland in September 1939, triggering declarations of war from the United Kingdom and France, the president was beholden to the powerful isolationists in Congress, as well as the public who supported them. During his 1940 presidential campaign for a third term, Roosevelt played to public sentiment. "I have said this before and I shall say it again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars," he promised. He later regretted those words. Today, we all like to think we'd stand up to the Nazis. But back in 1940, for the most part, ordinary Americans were simply indifferent to European affairs. Even worse, in some quarters of the country, a more sinister component was taking hold. According to the 1930 U.S. Census, roughly 7 million people in America were German-born or second-generation German immigrants. While Hitler's rise in their home country appalled many, some German Americans embraced the Nazi ideology of anti-Semitism and white racial superiority and found that it had traction in the United States. Pro-Nazi organizations like the Christian Front and the German-American Bund emerged throughout the northeastern and midwestern states. These groups tried to spread an Americanized Nazi message that combined conservative social values and flag-waving patriotism with appeals to the anti-Semitism and racism already prevalent throughout the country. Some pro-Nazi groups established clubs and camps for young people, modeled after the Hitler Youth camps in Germany, where American boys and girls in New Jersey, Long Island, and elsewhere learned the Hitler salute and could be seen marching through small towns wearing Nazi armbands. On February 20, 1939, the German-American Bund organized a flagship rally in Madison Square Garden in New York City with an audience of 20,000. Behind the stage was a huge depiction of George Washington, flanked by both Nazi swastikas and American flags. the first speaker of the night declared, to great applause, that if George Washington were alive today, he would be friends with Adolf Hitler. The night's keynote speech was delivered by the Bund's national leader, Fritz Kuhn, who declared that patriotic Americans had a duty to fight for a Gentile America, free of all atheistic Jewish Marxist elements. When at one point a young Jewish man in the audience jumped on the stage to protest the event, Bund members surrounded him, knocked him down, then beat and kicked him in front of the crowd. It wasn't just grassroots organizations like the Bund that supported Hitler. Some prominent Americans were outspoken Nazi sympathizers. The renowned automaker Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Motor Company and one of the best-known Americans of his day, held overtly anti-Semitic views and was not afraid to express them. In his self-published newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, Ford wrote a screed with the headline, "The International Jew, the World's Problem." Adolf Hitler himself praised Ford's writing, saying that we look to Heinrich Ford as the leader of the growing fascist movement in America. We have just had his anti-Jewish articles translated and published. Even more influential was the famed American aviator Charles Lindbergh. Celebrated as a national hero, Lindbergh was a pro-German white supremacist who embraced the Nazis' anti-Semitism. Lindbergh said the field of aviation was one of those priceless possessions which permit the white race to live at all in a pressing sea of yellow, black, and brown. Lindbergh became a prominent spokesperson for a group called the America First Committee, which urged the United States to stay out of the European War. Rumors even spread that Lindbergh would run for president in 1940 to challenge Roosevelt. At the same time, some Americans were appalled by the Nazi threat and believed the United States should take a stronger stand against Hitler. Unsurprisingly, the Jewish American community was at the forefront. Having experienced anti-Semitism firsthand, they understood how quickly it could grow and spread. On November 9, 1938, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, erupted in Germany. That evening, the Nazi Party's domestic paramilitary force known as the SA instigated a nationwide pogrom against Jewish people and riled up German citizens to participate. Armed attackers destroyed 267 synagogues and ransacked hundreds of Jewish hospitals, schools, and businesses. The SA authorities beat, arrested, and sometimes killed helpless Jewish civilians as police looked on indifferently. Kristallnacht would pale in comparison to the greater horrors to come. But it was the first undeniable evidence of Nazi violence that reached the wide international public. Soon, Jewish Americans began pushing for the United States to confront the scourge of Nazism directly and with military force. This anti-Nazi sentiment was sometimes expressed in creative ways. In 1938, two Jewish comic book creators, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, gave birth to Superman, a character dressed in American colors who used his extraordinary strength to save people in desperate trouble. By 1940, two other working-class Jews, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, created Captain America as a direct response to Nazism. The first issue, cover dated March 1941, depicted a muscle-bound red, white, and blue hero punching out Adolf Hitler. It was an overt political statement at a time when most Americans opposed entry into the war. And it was a fantasy that the United States would stand up and defend the Jewish people and other vulnerable populations from Nazi violence. The truth, however, was that most Americans simply did not know or care about the threat of Nazism in Europe. They didn't want to get involved in another foreign conflict. Roosevelt couldn't have taken the country to war even if he'd wanted to. Given public opinion, Congress wouldn't have authorized it. Even after Hitler conquered most of Central Europe and after France fell to the Nazis in spring 1940, the United States still hadn't entered the conflict. Roosevelt did what he could short of committing troops. In March 1941, he signed the landmark Lend-Lease Bill, authorizing the United States to loan armaments and military supplies to the United Kingdom at no cost. The policy was met with internal political resistance. Lending war equipment is a good deal like lending chewing gum. You don't want it back, the isolationist Senator Robert Taft argued. But this program would prove critical to Britain's survival. Still, as of April 1941, a whopping 81% of Americans were opposed to the U.S. entering the conflict. Apparently, it would take an extraordinary event to change their minds. It was coming soon enough. Chapter 4. 2 years later, near Qom, Iran, November 1943. The transport plane's cabin is dark, with biting cold air streaming through it. Outside, below cloud level, the sky is black. Apart from the steady howl of the wind, the most noticeable sound is that of breathing, a steady inhale and exhale from the uniformed men seated around the cabin. The men, half a dozen of them, maybe more, are sitting on benches on either side of the dark space. They draw breath from military-grade oxygen tanks, each trying to ration their small supply. The plane had recently reached a peak altitude of 18,000 feet, where breathing is near impossible. Now, finally, the aircraft is descending, having cleared a mountain range. Just as a few of the men might have started panicking for lack of breath, oxygen returns to the cabin. On the shoulders of the men are red stars, the insignia of the Soviet Union's Red Army. The rifles and pistols they hold are Soviet weapons, and the men's boots and jackets are Soviet uniforms. If these men could spare the oxygen to speak in this dark, windy airplane cabin, they'd speak in Russian. Each of them also wears a parachute. In several minutes, a sergeant will open the cabin door, and the men will leap out. According to plan, they'll only drop a few seconds before releasing their chutes. After floating down several hundred feet in the black night, they'll land on a flat, sandy plain in the desert outside the city of Qom in Soviet-occupied Iran. Yet there's something very unusual about these Soviet paratroopers. The plane that carries them, a Ju-290 cargo craft that doubles as a heavy bomber, is not a Soviet plane, but a German one. The pilot is not a Soviet pilot, but a German one. The sergeant who will open the plane's cargo door is not a Soviet sergeant, but a sergeant of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. These parachutists may be disguised as Red Army soldiers, but in fact, they're Nazi agents. A special division of the SS intelligence services in Berlin trained them and sent them here. If all goes to plan, once they hit the ground, they won't be recognized as the enemy. And why should they be? They're wielding Soviet weapons and wearing Soviet uniforms with authentic red stars on their shoulders. From outside the city of Qom, these men have instructions to meet local handlers and load onto trucks that'll take them to the capital city of Tehran. There, their secret mission begins.
Thank you for listening to this clip provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.